What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. What is the DNA of who you are and what you do? For today's guest, the answer is in the notes and chords that make up the foundation of his music. Randy George is a bass player and multi-instrumentalist, most known for his work with Neil Morse. In this conversation, he shares the importance of trial and error and the role influences play in discovering new sounds. He talks about the value of listening and hearing where the music wants to go, being flexible in the collaborative process, and how risk, doubt, and learning from failure are critical, no matter where you are in your career. We also dive into his fascination with film and TV production. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/543. You're just such a prolific musician and creator. What fuels your imagination when you're creating this work?
Well, I suppose, you know, anything and everything that I ever really listened to, you always take an idea and think, what is this going to sound like? And even if it doesn't sound like anything anybody else has ever done, to some degree, you know, you're going to have notes and chords. So, yeah, it's going to sound like something. I don't know. You know, I guess I try to zero in on what the song is trying to be. And I'll just try things. You know, a lot of times it's trial and error. You just throw out ideas. I've had an entire song where I laid the whole thing out. Once I started working with the vocalist, I realized it really needs to be in a different direction entirely. And so I went back and redid most of it to make it more of a vibe that I felt like the singer was bringing to it. Yeah, it's a lot of trial and error. You just have to try different things until you find something that sticks. And that, you know, as you listen to it over and over, over a few days or whatever, you know, you're still convinced that it's the idea. And, you know, give it a little bit of the test of time, and I don't know. I guess that's just how I go about it.
Yeah, I love that. It's so interesting because I know you as a bass player, but sitting behind you are keyboards, and leading up to our time together, I was listening to In the Light of the King's Countenance and just taking in all of the different musical instruments that you play. Like, is there one in particular that you write in, or do you just hear notes and chords?
I guess it depends on what I'm writing. I tend to like to flesh out songs on keyboard. But when you mentioned, you know, like In the Light of the King's Countenance, you know, most of that, the guitar part was what was written first. And then I went back on the keyboard and wrote parts for, you know, real orchestral instruments. So I did that, and then I hired, you know, guys from the Pacific Northwest Ballet and Seattle Symphony and stuff. They'd come in and do just standard union sessions. And the beauty is they're great readers. So all I had to do was stick the music in front of them, let them listen to it once, and they made their notes, and bam, they gave me a track back with, you know, once, twice through. We did a second pass where we recorded, you know, where we were actually going for a take. If we did do a second pass, it was just for the heck of it. They almost always nail it on the first pass.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and it depends on the person you work with. Some of these guys are more flexible than others. But most of them are all pretty well known in their particular arenas, you know, on that particular album. So yeah, you know, I had a great violinist, great oboe players, you know, some clarinet, a G flute, regular flute, a bagpipe guy, accordion guy, had them come in.
I love that you have a bagpipe guy. That's great.
Yeah, he played elbow small pipes, or Ellen pipes as they're pronounced, but it's spelled like Ewillian or something like that. So you might see that on Celtic music, but they're basically, it's a chanter that you put on your knee, and then the bag under your arm, and the bag blows the chanter. and you play, as opposed to Highland pipes, which you blow into.
Oh, interesting.
Doing that, I learned a lot about orchestral instruments and writing for different instruments. I learned quite a bit doing that.
Yeah. And when you said you put music in front of them, like, are you transcribing the music as well, or are you working with someone to do that for you?
Oh, no, I just played it in the cakewalk and printed it out.
Okay. It's that simple then. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're good enough to figure it out. Wasn't exactly what they're used to getting. At least the oboe player certainly was, you know, he was kind of like, oh, usually this is written this way, you know, for oboe, you know. He's a muzzle cloth. Yada, yada, this, that, the other thing. Oh, man, I'm sorry. I'm kind of. He called back later. Said, yeah, man, I'm sorry. Good luck on your project. It's really good.
That's awesome.
And then other people like Nancy Rumble, I brought her in. She was just great. She could improvise. She could do that stuff. Classical players from the symphony, they are excellent readers. And if it's on the paper, they'll play it. If you ask them to make something up on the spot, you're wasting your time. Most of the time, they just aren't good that way. They're used to reading it. But occasionally, you will find players in those circles who are good at some kind of improv. So, you know, that's always cool when that happens. But I brought them in to play a part that I had written. They did. So it wasn't any big deal.
Yeah. When did you know you wanted to be a musician? Was that something that you came, you know, early on in your life, or did you stumble on it?
No, I think it was, I had a sister who was about 7 years older. So when I was about, 6 or 7 years old, you know, she's 12 or 13, you know. And so, you know, the age difference was such that she was really starting to get into different things of the day. I had the things that I was getting into, but, you know, I tended to adopt some of the things she would listen to, and then I hated some of the things she listened to. But, you know, through all that, I learned to listen to the radio. I learned to play records. We went out and bought 45s, and we used to jam along. You know, I used to play air guitar as a kid.
Nice.
I was a rock star. I don't know, for some reason, even before I even knew what any of it was about, I wanted to do it. My dad never took me too seriously because he was a music type, but he knew the reality of trying to make it music. So he didn't really put much stock into it. But for some reason, it's just that it called me really early on in life, and I just never sort of let it go. I just forged ahead, you know, whatever instrument was available to me, which was initially piano. I think I got my first bass when I was 12.
Oh, wow. So when you're 12 and you're picking up the bass, who were your heroes that you wanted to emulate?
Oh, well, immediately, I think when I got my first bass, that was the year 1974. However, I had been listening to music, obviously, several years before that. And, you know, I'd gone out and bought, like, Moody Blues, Quest and Balance, and started buying the Moody Blues catalog. Roundabout was out. It was a song that got released in 1970, and it played on the radio. And so, you know, it was one of those, I listened to the radio to hoping it would come on, kind of thing, because it's a cool song. And I didn't really understand why I liked it or why it was so cool, but it just was. And I just was naturally attracted to that style of music. I think I'm just a singer in a rock and roll band. Was probably one of the very first things I ever learned on bass. I had one of those console stereos, you know, with the record player and the radio in the middle.
Okay.
Speakers. It was just a whole big piece of furniture. And it's sit my little Fender Music Master amp right on top of it on one side, sit and play along, you know, with Moody Blues initially. And you just sort of pick it up as you go. You hear things that stand out to you and you try to figure them out. It's a lot of that. I started playing at the Catholic Church across the street. I was doing that pretty early on too. So that gave me an opportunity to actually play with other people, even though we were playing Catholic, you know, camp songs. But, you know, they weren't too particular about how they wanted things, you know. So it was, I had a lot of freedom to experiment. I don't know, it all came to me pretty naturally.
It sounds like, too, you really refined that sense early on of how to listen and translate that into the music itself.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. Not everybody does that, at least well. You know, you're either predisposed to having an ear, being able to pick stuff out, hear it, or you learn how to do it from a strictly, you know, an academic standpoint where you learn to read music. Some people learn that way too. Everybody's different. It's going to be a little different for everybody. I wasn't much for the academic route, really. I think I had such a strong inclination to hear things by ear that it didn't really help to look at music. So I guess I never really learned to sight read, but I did learn theory quite well, like scoring and arranging in school. But they don't really teach you how to write or play the kind of stuff you really want to play. But it is a fundamental understanding of what you're doing that I think is an invaluable tool to have.
Yeah.
Because you understand the relationships of notes and chords and things to each other. And so in a lot of ways, you asked, you know, how what inspires me when I write, it's hearing where it wants to go. Mm. You know, it's being able to hear that there's this way, there's that way. And you can listen to songs and different music and hear what different people do. And you have an understanding of what it is from a standpoint of, theory. I understand the chord progressions. You know, I understand what chords they're playing because I can hear them. I know exactly what they are. And so you kind of learn by hearing and then doing.
Mm.
Sometimes you'll write stuff that you've listened to, and sometimes you'll write something that, you know, is right out of a song. You don't even discover it until years later. You think, oh, that's what that is. Here I had this melody in my head, and I couldn't tie it to anything. And then all of a sudden, you know, you realize, oh, that's what it was.
Mm.
You know, of course, many years down the road after, it's too late to do anything about it.
Didn't that just happen recently with the Yes's new song where the keyboardist put a release out saying that he had used a piece of music that he thought was his, but it ended up being someone else's?
Yeah, I guess it's bound to happen, especially if you do a lot. You know, with Neil Morris, it's a lot of that. A lot of, making sure he's not repeating himself. And he does. He will play exact phrases from songs. In the search for the, you know, where's this going? And when we're writing a piece of music. And, what about this? And then he'll play like the beginning of gibberish or something, or the beginning of thoughts, or I don't remember the song, but you know, be like, that's right out of the thing, you know, check it out and listen to it. It is the exact same phrase.
Oh, weird.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think he's always amazed that I remember that stuff. I think most of the guys are. See, I'm really good that way. That I remember things everybody else forgets.
Really?
Yeah. I know what every song on every album sounds like in my head.
Wow.
I can relate to it. So if I hear something and I know exactly what it is, it's like, well, that sounds just like this. And he'll, you know, he's like, I've forgot about that song. So, you know, that's kind of a big part of our process in just policing ourselves to make sure that, that we're not repeating ourselves too much. It's somehow in the end, no matter what, you're always steering clear of that. And in the end, it still sounds like everything else. But I mean, there doesn't seem to be any way around that. Try as we might.
Yeah. I mean, what a superpower, though, to be able to like have that memory of everything that you've done and heard.
Well, for years, I just thought everybody could do that. I didn't know it was, the more and more as time has gone on, the older I get, I realize everything is just me. You know, everybody else is different. You know, everybody else is normal. I'm the one that's different. You know, and I've had to kind of accept that because I sit down and play with guys who just do like really great basic rock blues, and they're just really natural at it, songwriter types, and sit down and play with them. I feel like a square peg trying to fit through a round hole. Because I'm not a blues guy. I haven't got an ounce of blues in me. I never liked the blues and I never played the blues. I just, you know, it's just not my thing. So, you know, it's funny how you will become a creature of your own habits.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I could sit and listen to Stevie Ray Vaughan. Most of the time, I could kind of listen to him indefinitely because there's something about the way he did what he did that made it really attractive to my ears. you know, versus some of the people he's emulating, you know.
Right.
Who originally did that. It's kind of like, yeah, it's kind of boring. boring.
It is interesting too, like blues is very pattern based. And, you know, when you get into things like prog, you can bring patterns into prog. I mean, do you rely on patterns and riffs when you're, you know, in the world of, you know, sola scriptura or similitude of a dream?
Oh, sure. You'll implement moments from just about everything. If I feel like I hear something in a section, you know, it easily could be tied to a classic song. It might even be a top 40 song from the 70s. And it would be kind of like, you know, I mean, in a lot of the bass stuff I do will sound a lot like bass players from the 70s. That's what I grew up learning. Even in the more basic rock progressions, you'll hear that. You know, I'm not necessarily trying to be Chris Squire in everything I do. I guess I started really wanting to be that, and I sort of ended up wanting to be that. But in the middle, I went a lot of different directions. And I learned a lot of different styles. It really wasn't until I started playing with Neil that I came back to the more picked, busy bass thing. So, you know, a lot of times when we're playing, though, I'm hearing a lot of classic players and the types of things they played in their day, Joe Osborne, so forth, those kind of guys, you know, from back in that day. And throughout, you know, it doesn't matter when it was. I listen to music, and if something kind of reminds me of something and I like that direction, I might borrow the vibe, or I might borrow a similar rhythmic type figure against whatever the new piece we're working on. Because it, to me, I connect, wow, that reminds me of this. And nobody else will hear that except me. I'll be the one that I hear. But it doesn't matter because I'm just playing bass. I'm not trying to get everybody else to, like, hey, if we did this and this and this, then it would sound just like this. In a lot of ways, though, they all came up, you know, everybody that we play, you know, all of us that play together listen to a lot of the same stuff. So, it's an organic process when that happens. It's not like we go out of our way to try to do that. It just happens. But it happens because I think everybody's, you know, playing off the same playbook to some degree.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, because from a listener's perspective, you can hear the finished product and just marvel at what's done. But I love how you're bringing in the idea that, you know, you're all listening to a lot of the same music and fueling a lot of those ideas through this process of writing. That's so interesting.
You're going to write basically from a place that you feel is you. You don't really hear that you are the sum of everything you listen to until it's done and you're on the other end. You're listening as a listener, but you can never really hear it for the first time, but you can hear that, wow, we really do sound like this, or we really do sound like that. I didn't really ever think about it or realize it until somebody mentioned it, and then it's like, wow, it does sound like that. But, you know, you weren't thinking that when you were writing and recording it. It's just, you're just sort of organically arriving at where you naturally think it should go.
When you're exploring different, you know, sounds and different genres and different styles of music, at what point do you embrace who you are and be like, this is me, this is my sound, this is the DNA of Randy George?
That happens at the moment you realize there's about a million guys who are way better than you are. And that's always the way it's going to be. And it doesn't matter how good anybody thinks I am. There's a ton of guys out there that are way better than I am at various things. And everybody's good at something, you know. I don't necessarily do everything, so I can't be great at everything. I feel like I'm great at what I do. And there aren't a lot of guys doing what I do anymore. I stopped entirely, probably by the end of the 80s. I was like, well, that kind of bass playing just, it doesn't exist anymore. Nobody wants to hear it. Nobody wants to play it. And, you know, it's gravitating more toward fusion, R&B, various things. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, I've been playing that stuff for so long. I want to play other stuff. So I learned how to play some, you know, funk and pop slap type stuff and finger. I played it strictly with fingers. I didn't play with a pick for over 10 years.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I was like exploring different things, because new guys were coming out like in the early 90s. You had Stu Hamm who was out there doing solo bass records that were really cool. And, oh, there's a bunch of new riffs to learn. And Michael Manring would be doing something really cool, his Windmill stuff. And you listen to what different guys are doing out there thinking, wow, you know, this is really cool. It opens up a whole new door of possibilities for you every time you get into different music you didn't know somebody, you know, was doing. And of course, you know, I discovered so many great players along the way, and they all have something really cool to offer. But that's their DNA, and that's what they do. I had to realize I'm not them. You know, and as much as it might be intimidating to sit and watch a guy like Brian Bromberg, you know, I also have to remember that, well, I could probably play most of his riffs and what he's doing. It's not really in my DNA to just do that naturally. I'd have to learn it. He's doing it naturally because that's where he's coming from. That's who he is. And it comes organically to him. You know, for me, it'd be a process of learning, practicing, and I can do it, but it's just, you know, it's just not going to be quite as natural of a process. It's a learned process. And so you learn from the people you can learn from. But I also realized that there's a lot that happens that I don't really do, and a lot of guys that do it. And they probably do it better than I do because they do it all the time. That's what's in their DNA.
Yeah.
It's not. So I had to look at, well, no matter what, and I think for years I thought playing with the Neil Morse Band was great. It gave me a different kind of platform for people to view me as a player and understand where I'm coming from. And yet, you know, in the end, it's like, well, I've created a niche for myself that's very unique. And I watch guys try to cover it. And, you know, a lot of guys will try to play it with their fingers and it just doesn't work. And I just had to realize, well, this truly is me. This is where I started. This is the kind of stuff I grew up playing and learning. I don't know. I guess I'm a good fit for this particular group because we all work very much the same way in how we write and record. And that's been really beneficial. Having a very similar work ethic and an approach to how we do things and being able to do things quickly. It's been a process over the years to unattach from music ideas. I may write ideas and musical ideas and you bring them in, and if they got used in the end, they didn't really end up sounding like anything you did originally. It's credited to you, but it's like that it's not really the rope. You know, this is what you did with it. Okay, fair enough. You know, you get the compromise that you always arrive at. Over the years, you sort of learn, well, the best thing to do now is just to bring stuff that you don't really care if it gets changed. Not be so attached emotionally to what you do that you can't change it or work with somebody else who may have some ideas on it. Even if you don't like it as much as what you originally did, it's a flexibility issue. And being able to just meet other people, you know, in the middle with it and just let it go. That was something that, you know, took some time to learn how to do. And, you know, in the end, I think everything always ended up really good no matter what. Just because something didn't get done exactly the way I thought it should be doesn't mean that it didn't turn out really good. It did. And it's just different than what I was thinking at the time. Years later, it doesn't even matter because I can't even remember what I was thinking at the time. All I have is what's on the recording. And it's like, oh, that's what we did. Stuff that we haven't played in a long time. Sometimes I will adjust how I play it because, you know, over time, you know, a lot of times when we were doing songs back in the day on some of these albums, I'd be kind of at a loss. What could I do here that would be really cool? And I feel like sometimes, you know, you just simplify and try to just do the most basic thing you can, stay out of the way of everything else, mostly because you try a bunch of different things that none of which seem to work.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, you back off and start minimalizing, you know, what you're playing. And then over the years, you know, you're kind of like, oh, wow, I should have totally done this, or I should have totally done that, you know. But if you play it live, you can sort of test it out and see if the way you hear it now works any better than the way it was originally recorded. Sometimes stuff just has to end up that way. The drums have to play in a certain way to get through a section, because it just, what worked on recording doesn't necessarily always work live.
Right.
So.
Oh, interesting.
Sometimes there's a lot of flexibility that has to, you have to learn to just be flexible, not be too attached. You know, just try to capture the moment and do it. And you know, I mean, if I want it exactly the way I want it, then that's what a solo album is for.
So true. Because I imagine, you know, being someone who can write your own album, but then also collaborating with Neil and Mike and Eric and Bill and all these different types of projects. I mean, you almost get this best of both worlds where you can have like your ego projects, but then the collaboration projects.
Yeah. Over the years, I watched how strife in bands always stemmed from, you know, one person not ever getting to do what they thought should be done or whatever. There's always some kind of clash of egos. And I'm kind of like, you know, man, none of that's worth getting bent out of shape over. Right. You know, I guess if they had known in the 70s that, you know, throughout the 90s and the 2Ks, you know, they'd still be touring and playing to major audiences, assuming they were even together, or that they might actually be able to come back together in those days. Nobody in those days thought they'd still be doing it at that age. You know, everybody figured that it was 10 years, maybe the most, and you're done. Mm-hmm. And it was for a lot of them. But yeah, I don't know. How different would things be if people had seen the big picture? You always hear about how somebody didn't really want to play by the rules or do what the record company wanted to because they wanted to do their own thing. It's like, well, you know, stick it out for a few albums. Once you guys have a few albums out and you're really established, then you can do whatever you want. Mm. Then you can do those things and you have the resources and the money behind you to do it. And if it falls flat, then it falls flat, but you know, you're in a framework of something much bigger. So, you know, and a lot of albums that have fallen flat and took a serious bath are great albums. Trevor Rabin, Can't Look Away, is a good example. Spent a ton of money on it. And I thought it was a great album. I love that album. But, you know, from a record company standpoint, it tanked. It doesn't always end up, you know, being successful as you think. But, you know, a lot of times you just have to visualize that, okay, this is what happens here. Just roll with it. Don't worry about it. And then take, you know, your off time, you go off and do something else that makes you a lot more happy. And you don't ever have to look at just being in one band. And look at Mike, he's never in just one band. So
no, he's really, you know, not.
Yeah. And I guess everybody's wired a little differently. So there's no way to tell for sure. But for me, I just find it a whole lot more feasible to remain flexible and to just sort of give where I have to give in a collaborative situation, as long as everything's moving toward, you know, a successful ending, then, you know, I just take whatever I think is so important to do and find another outlet for it. And oftentimes I've realized, you know, sometimes your ideas aren't as good as you thought they were at the time.
That what? You wanted. No, no, they're always great.
Yeah, not always. Sometimes it's just like, this is cheesy. This is just not really working for me. And you might use it later. I know I bird on a wire from this new Innocence of Danger. It's from a demo, an old demo I've had for years. I forget even where I put it together. I don't even remember when I put it together, but it's been around for a long time. And I didn't know what to do with it. And I've never, you know, I bring it out whenever I'm talking to people about doing stuff, you know, if I need to come up with some demos. I've even brought it to previous albums.
Oh, interesting.
The recordings. We've listened to it as a demo, as a possibility for previous albums, and it got shot down.
What made it different this time?
Number one, some people aren't very good at remembering this thing. So they're hearing it again, but to them it's the first time they're hearing it. Second of all, they're not focused in on some particular path and idea that they want to explore, and so they're really open to whatever. And so you play it, sounds good. Oh, we can work with it. Let's try that. You know, it's a mindset.
Interesting.
You have to be in the right place, I guess, to do that. You know, to be open to that. You know, Innocence is in Danger was a lot of, Neil didn't have anything. I guess that makes a huge difference. When Neil has nothing, then pretty much anything is fair game.
Yeah, interesting.
And he's willing to run with something if he feels like, you know, he can sink his vocal into it and it just resonates on some level with him. You know, he'll go for it, and then he'll make something out of it, or, you know, just make a song. He'll find the song in it, figure out a way to turn it into an actual song. Because usually when I bring demos, they're just music. They rarely ever have any kind of vocal.
I love Bird on a Wire a lot. And the thing that honestly stood out the most in that track was your bass playing. I mean, it just sounded so fresh, and like it was a great mix. And then you got a bass solo even. Like, I love that kind of middle bass solo. Woo.
Yeah. Again, you know, very much a Chris Squire-ism kind of vibe. You know, I felt like it needed that kind of thing. You know, Chris Squire is the one who used to do those kind of things. So if I hear that kind of opportunity, I think, you know, something like Run with the Fox, you know, where he's, you know, does stuff up high just as a passing thing. So, but, you know, I think the demo that I originally brought in for that was very influenced by Spock's beard. You know, it was a Spock's beard kind of idea to me.
That is wild. That has to be a wild experience to be playing with Neil, but being inspired by past Neil.
Well, yeah, because, you know, Neil has had, he's had a lot of different things that he's done, and really quite a bit. But there are moments that I thought were just perfect that never really got repeated much. So I'm always looking for opportunities to try to recapture some of the better moments of what he's done in the past. You know, because stuff he writes nowadays, you know, you fall into sort of this groove that you write in, and you sort of fall into different vibes and grooves, and they change over the years. You won't necessarily approach or write something the way you did when you were much younger.
Yeah.
You know, so trying to recapture some of that, to me, you know, I if there's an opportunity to do that, I like to do that. So I had written this idea to try to kind of do that a little bit, but it never got used. It sat around for years and years and years and years. Finally got used.
That's awesome. Is that where like Thoughts Part 5 came around, where you're listening to like Thoughts and Thoughts Part 2 and you get inspired to like, because I think I remember hearing something about the twisted mind of Randy George or something like that?
To a degree, but it wasn't so much, it was more conceptually that I wanted to do a Thoughts Part 3. I said, we should do Thoughts Part 3. And I had mentioned it to him several times. But that time we actually sat around and put together some ideas and wrote it like the day before Mike showed up for the recording session. This was for Momentum. So we wrote that whole song the day before we started the track.
Amazing.
And I thought, yeah, that's Part 3, and he gets ready, it's time, you know, you should do one. And that was strictly conceptual. It wasn't that I thought it should sound like the other Thoughts, you know, at all. But I think Neil understood the reference. He understood
nice. What
it meant to do another Thoughts, and what he would normally go for. And that's what it ended up being. He changed it to Thoughts Part 5 because I think at some point it dawned on him that he'd been talking to Al, and Al had mentioned that at one point they were working on a Thoughts Part 3, but it never happened, I don't think. But I think Neil wanted to make sure that they had the opportunity to see that through if they were going to do it. Mm-hmm. So he figured, let's just push it up to like Part 5. That way Spock wants to do a couple more iterations of it. You know, it's free for them to do that. That's what that's all about.
That's so interesting. I really like what you were saying earlier too about, you know, things are different when you're younger versus as you get older. And I think, you know, whether it's playing in a band, being a musician, being a podcaster, being a filmmaker or designer, how you grow into your craft, grow into your career, and keep that progression is so fascinating. I mean, I love what you're sharing. I mean, any other insights into how people can do that?
I don't know. You know, it's like I said, it's different for everybody. there's no right way or wrong way to go about it. I think you just have to, the bottom line is it's trial and error. It's always going to be trial and error, no matter what level you're working on. You won't get better at something until you fail and understand why this didn't work so well. Mm-hmm. And then you start examining things that do work really well. And you try to draw some kind of contrast so you have an idea of what you could do better or how you could make something better. And every album is a step forward. You know, we don't always know what the album's going to be at the beginning. We didn't know what Similitude was going to be. But Neil had an idea of what he was after. And then when we did The Great Adventure, we were trying to go in a completely different direction, but Neil was still stuck on a sequel. We even did a completely different album.
Yeah.
And then went back and Neil completely reorganized the whole thing into what he thought it should be as a sequel. And then we had to get together and sort through that and do what we do the normal process, given that version of the album to get our final one. Because in his reimagining of the whole thing, he left off some things that the rest of us, they're like, oh, I wanted that idea. I really like the way this worked. And da, da, da. There was lots of things that we had to go back and put back in. Yeah, it's trial and error. You learn because you do it, and you know that, I know that's probably not going to work because we tried that before. Mm-hmm. And it's never worked.
It's never worked. I love that. At what point does risk enter the picture in terms of, you know, trying something new and not being afraid to take a chance?
We do it all the time. It happens, I think, a little more on albums where maybe it isn't as much written. You know, trying to write an album like the last couple, Similitude and Great Adventure, you're writing to a storyline, and so you kind of have to follow the story. The music has to undergird what the story's being told, and yada, yada, yada. So that can be really tricky in that respect. When you're doing an album like Innocence and Danger, there's a lot more freedom because you're not writing to a storyline. And so you can take more chances in that respect because there's nothing tying you down to a specific idea or a direction or whatever. Have you gotten a copy of the whole album yet?
No, I've just heard the two singles.
Okay. Well, you know, once you get the full album, like the epic Beyond the Years, for instance, there's sections in there. We just, you know, you get to a point where like, well, we need something here. What do we need now? Where are we going next? And you start just throwing out ideas. And nothing seems to really be sticking to the wall. And I'm thinking, well, he set this up like Dance on a Volcano is what he did. Mm. And so I started playing something similar to the end of Dance on the studio version. You know, so I started just kind of tongue in cheek. I threw out this idea, and Neil's just looking at me and says, is that something? I said, no, I'm just making it up. Well, can we use that? I think that's exactly what it needs, is something like that. So a lot of times we kind of all kind of hear where it wants to go, but nobody's really sure exactly what to throw out there to illustrate it.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that's what I will do. I will illustrate what I hear or what I think because it reminds me of something, you know, else that did that. I thought, oh, it worked for them then, you know, it'll work for us now.
That's cool.
So, you know, you never know what things will inspire you, you know, to try things, but everything's a bit of an experiment. Everything's a bit of a, you know, and as long as Neil knows he can sing to it, you know, we're good. But, you know, even down the line after we're all home working on it, it'd be like, well, I think there needs more drums in this section, or I think it needs to be, you know, I think, you know, there should be a break right here. I want to do this vocal break right here. You know, we doubled that chorus at the end, Bill. Could you maybe needs some kind of vocal thing there. Can you, you know, write something on that second time around? Can you write something for that so it'll be more interesting? Yeah, I think it's just, you know, just taking and doing what we do and running with it. It's all a big experiment. You never know until the end comes around and you start really hearing it all together and blending and mixed. And you're just like, wow. Yeah. You're often surprised at how cool something really turned out. Sometimes it's more often, I think it's there's some doubts about things early on that remain for a while until we get to a point where you're hearing the mixes back, and then in the doubts start to fall away. Oh, I didn't really think that was going to work that well, but man, it was really good. You know.
I'm really glad to know that doubt still enters the picture, even, you know, well into the career that you've had. So, I mean, that gives me a lot of hope when I'm faced with doubts in my own world.
Well, people aren't supermen. As a kid, what really drew me into music, you know, was the mystique of the bands.
Yeah.
Bands in the 70s had a mystique. And the mystique was they were untouchable. You couldn't get to them. They weren't accessible. There were these people who did this stuff. And if you went to the concert, saw them in concert, but God forbid you should ever get in proximity to meet them.
Right.
You know, they were very shut off from everything around them. It's very different now.
Yeah.
It's just the opposite now. Everybody's like an open book, and they're, you know, it's just the way things have gone. Having met a lot of these guys and talked about those days, talked about their career in those days and how they did things, even working with some of them, you know, you realize that they didn't do what we do. Mm-hmm. They didn't sit there and discuss, you know, oh, well, where are we going next? Okay, yeah, let's do that. And then here's the next. And before you know it, you've written 30 minutes of music. They will argue about 30 seconds of music for 6 days.
Right.
30 seconds of music, they'd argue for 6 days until they made a decision on what to do with it. It wasn't that hard. But back in the day, they were also in the studio writing their music and learning it and playing it. They weren't recording it. They were writing it and learning to play it. Mm-hmm. Then they went out and toured and played the music live in front of audiences before they were allowed to come into the studio and make a record of it. That's how things were done. See, we don't have that. We're kind of building it as we go.
Yeah,
we're just mapping out what is essentially the demos. But ultimately, if there's something we like, we can keep it because we're building it within the framework that you built the final album in anyway. They didn't have the luxury of doing that. You know, they'd go in the studio. You know, I remember, you know, asking, and I was all, I remember we went in the studio, and I think we did 3 takes, and that was the best one. You know, they just kept the best of the three. The Beatles did that all the time.
Paul McCartney has an interesting show on Hulu with Rick Rubin where they dissect the Beatles tracks.
That's really good to watch. It gives you a really, really different insight. And I mean, and all those things, they just reinforce how similar things were to them in their day than they are now. You know, technology's changed things a lot. A lot of that kind of stuff's still very similar. It's just one generation after another. So maybe, you know, there's a little more of a derivative thing happening at some times. But nonetheless, much of it is the same. We've eliminated needing, you know, 10 people around you to do it.
Right.
You know, you have a guy running the studio console. There's no producer sitting there. You don't have George Martin sitting there with arrangements. You don't have, you know, what are you doing it all yourself? And that's different. The fact that we can do what we do. Boy, a lot of these guys, if you talk to them, they would have loved to have something like Pro Tools back then.
For sure.
Yeah, if they had to punch in something or whatever, you had to punch in and then punch it out. And you'd hope you got it, hope that it worked. You know, it didn't always work either. So it's just a different process back then, and they probably weren't dissecting the details the way we do. They were writing more as a group. You know, I've got this, why don't we try this? Play it for a little while, okay. Somebody else will throw in another idea, and they'll just sort of put it together. And we kind of do that same thing, but like I said, we're the architects as well. You know, the architects, we're the builder. Where all the components that back then, they had people around them that did all that. You had like George Martin, who could arrange for an orchestra, or he could bring an orchestra in and play to what they were doing. They didn't know how to do that, but the fact that somebody did, and it inspired them to try things that they would have not tried otherwise.
Yeah.
But now, you know, we have now we're like, well, you know, we you know, get the strings to come in and play that, get the horn guys to come in and do that.
Right.
You know, for now, just do it on the keyboard, right? Map it out on the keyboard and mock it up. Then you get the real guys to come in and record it. And, you know, we just have a whole different mindset toward it. But many of the processes aren't that drastically different. People are different. You know, those guys, they would never be able to work with those old British and Asian guys mm-hmm. working in the studio with us. They'd be like, man, you guys are machines. I don't know how you do it, you know.
Right. What is this anarchy? Then,
yeah, because they remember taking 6 days to decide on 30 seconds of music, ooh, you know, and arguing about it. Yeah. It's just they remember that stuff because they'd be in the studio for 6 months trying to do all this stuff. But back then, the record company was paying for all of that. You know, now we have our own studios, so we sit in our own studios and do the same thing without a whole lot of extra input from people. So that's how things have changed a lot. But it's funny how many of the things that you just do in the process to come up with ideas, they're not really any different. And when I listen to McCartney talking his program about some of these songs, it's like I can totally relate to what he's saying because we do the exact same thing. Yeah. Oh, see here, see this riff here. That's Little Richard. It's from this song right here, and they play the Little Richard song, and you'd be like, it's the same riff. Say it's the same riff, and Paul would be like, say it's the exact same thing. We stole it. You know, we stole it and used it. So you know, when you asked me before about you know how much of the influences, you know, get into the music, and it's kind of the same exact thing. Yeah, that's why we ended up being, oh, there's the Genesis section.
Right.
Let's get to it's the Supertramp section, you know, whatever, you know, the King Crimson section. There's always a name for it because it reminds somebody of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to sound like it or even be like it, but if it reminds somebody of it, it's going to be a way for them to remember that part. Then it'll get a name like that.
That's brilliant. Because how do you remember a 30-minute song without that?
Yeah, you hear it, you do it. What goes in comes out. It's inevitable.
One of the things that I have to ask, I know we're kind of coming to the end of this, but I have to ask this. What inspired you to pick up a camera and be the documentarian of the album and the writing of the work? Because you are the guy that edits and records a lot of the behind the scenes stuff.
Well, because I'm the only one who could. Nobody else was going to do it. Nobody else had the patience for it. Nobody else had the equipment for it. And those that did, it was kind of one of those things where it's another creative outlet. You've got all this stuff, but you have to organize it in a way that you can sort of tell a story. So it takes a long time to watch through everything. Right. But I also have a fascination with film and television production. I've been into that for many, many years too, even as a little kid, because I grew up in front of the TV like most of my generation. You know? Mm-hmm. And it was a thing. Same mystique, the whole mystique of Hollywood, what it would be like to have been in Hollywood in the late 60s at a studio where, you know, you're running around and, you know, they're filming Lost in Space over here, and Brady Bunch over here, and Mission Impossible over here. And they're all right there, you know, it's all going on. And I thought, man, what a time that would have been to be there. I met so many of those people and listened to their way, you know, their stories and talk about, you know, their school. And that was their school. They had to go to school 4 hours a day in a trailer right there on the studio lot. Just the whole lifestyle of being part of that and just being real interested in production. And I've just watched a lot of things. So once we started meeting sort of a video thing, I started thinking, well, there's got to be a way to make these look better than just a bunch of strung together clips. So I got Final Cut and I started, trial and error. The first one I did was the behind the scenes tour doc from Testimony 2 tour. That was the first one I did. And I did that in iMovie.
Nice.
So that was, but I made it look a whole lot more nicer than just a bunch of random footage. I tried to give it, you know, some flow, and take you along for the ride, basically, and enhance it. Mm-hmm. Like I think every one of those tour documentaries has a plane landing. I usually try to find the airline that we took and the exact airport we came in at. And it probably is exactly what it looked like when we landed.
That's amazing.
It's just some stock footage, but
yeah,
you know, it's a Southwest Airlines 737 landing in Tampa. And that's exactly what we were on, and we landed in Tampa. So it had to look just like that, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
just, we weren't on the exact plane. But it adds to that, you know, the travel. It keeps you going, and it keeps you in the travel with us. So, you know, I try to use whatever I can to enhance it and give it a more polished look and feel. And filming the stuff is tough because you're always limited by the quality of the footage you get. And without having somebody running the camera, you're often doing it yourself. And so it makes it difficult because it's like, oh, I got some great studio footage, but right where I want to see Mike, there's no footage.
Right.
You know, there's no footage of him at that moment. Or, would have been great, but Neil went and took the camera and went somewhere with it.
Or left his door open when he was doing Lifeline.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, man. So that's all I have. And then I didn't get what I actually, you know, was hoping that would be there. It wasn't there. You just take what's there and try to make it look as good as possible. So, you know, I ended up doing that so much. And I've done over 40 features, I think.
Amazing.
Yeah, between music videos and documentary features. Yeah, there's over 40 that I've edited. Yeah, it's interesting. I go back and watch through some of them because I remember things that I really liked about them, you know. Or I discovered things that I had forgotten, you know, and then it inspires me like, oh, okay, so this is what I'm getting ready to do. Maybe I'll try that. See if I can make this work or try that or do this. That was a good idea. I liked it when it, you know, I did it before. So I'll do it again.
Yeah, I love that.
That kind of thing.
Well, Randy, on the day this releases, it's August 27th, the day that Innocence in Danger hits the street. And what are you excited about when people hear this new record?
I think it's a good record of songs. I think this band has only done one record of just standalone songs. There wasn't that many of them. More like, what, five songs? Something,
five, right? Yeah.
And there's a few bonus tracks. This is the length and breadth of this is so much more with standalone songs. So there's a lot of different varieties. So, you know, I'm just excited for people to hear it all. The people who might be thinking it's a little poppy at first, because for some reason all the videos are poppy songs.
Right.
There's a whole album of proggy stuff that's really heavy too. Which isn't what's on the videos. So I think people can be really excited to hear that part of it as well. There's something for everybody. It'll be interesting. So I'm just excited to see it get out there and people to hear it.
Well, I hope to see you in Seattle in October. And as a fan, I want to thank you so much for all of the wonderful music over the years. Thank you for your time today. It has truly been an honor to spend this time with you, Randy.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
As mentioned in this conversation, the latest album by the Neil Morse Band, Innocence and Danger, is now available as of today. You can get it wherever you buy your music or stream it online at Waterfall Streaming. I, for one, can't wait to dive in and listen. I think it's going to be a pretty awesome record, although I say that with every album. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.